At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. This is a not only very special episode that we're about to get into, but it's a special little project we're going to do here for the month of April. I've been talking about it throughout March. Last week we had Dr. Art Laffer, and I announced that the month of April I'm doing something I want to call Mentor Month. There are four individuals that I credit as being significant mentors in my life and career, each in a very different aspect and a different lane. And I wanted to go through and talk to each one of them about the impact that they've had in my life and career and their own contributions to the very subjects that are at the heart of this podcast here at Capitol Record. The end of April, we're going to close up with myself, with my late father, Dr. Greg Bahnsen, where, of course, he has not been with us now for 28 years, but we were able to put together a really, I think, wonderful project around some of his old contributions to the subject of work and productivity for a philosopher and theologian, let alone for a Presbyterian. He was pretty astute in some of these elements. And so Greg Bahnsen represents, of course, my first mentor because I met him first, and on so many different levels, he had the biggest impact anybody could have ever had on me as my father, my best friend, my mentor, and so forth. But when you become an adult, let alone losing your father right as you are entering adult life, you form other mentors and connections as well, and I'm very blessed that this month there are three individuals besides my father are going to join us in this podcast. And the first of those is here with me today. And he's a gentleman by the name of Nick Murray. He's sitting here with me in my New York office. And Nick is someone who I have known, who I have been reading every month of my life since the very first month that I began life as a financial advisor. And so before I start chatting with Nick, I wanted to give a little background as to why Nick's here and the impact he's had in my life. I haven't often gone to Nick for marriage advice or parenting advice. I guess indirectly, there's things that do come up there too, by the way. But when I refer to his mentorship, we're referring to a very specific aspect of my chosen vocational field in the world of financial advisory. And what happened for me is, having sold the old music management business that I was a part of after my dad died until the point at which Jolene and I got engaged, and we had been going through the 1990s equity boom and living through the insanity of Super Bowl commercials for pets.com, I decided to enter the training program at a firm formerly known as Payne Webber that was quickly absorbed by UBS, a huge Swiss bank behemoth. And I began the first 6 years of my career there. And at the exact same time, got introduced by a friend of mine, I hope you're listening right now, Kevin Reed, who is currently a manager with Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, but had been a broker in the Merrill Lynch system back in the 90s. He said, yeah, check out this guy, Nick Murray. So luckily for me, as I'm recording here, my wife has walked outside the room. She's been with us here this morning. But Nick had a book that had come out. He had previously written a book called Excellent Investment Advisor, and then a newer kind of updated version called The New Financial Advisor came out. Jolene and I were married on September 8th, 2001. And we were in the air flying to Tahiti for our honeymoon when 9/11 happened. And we spent the first 10 days of our marriage locked down in Tahiti, but we were supposed to be there, so it wasn't really a lockdown for us. The world travel kind of reopened just in time for us to come back. So we had a normal honeymoon, as much as you could when your country was under attack. And I had not yet even taken my Series 7 license. I was in the training program at Payne Webber. I had started in it before the wedding, but was getting ready to kind of begin this new career. And we'd go down to the beach in Moorea or Bora Bora, and I'd bring one of Nick's books, and I'd underline the hell out of it and highlight it, and I still have both. I probably have as many words written in the margins of Nick's books as he wrote in the books. I devoured it without any context at all to what I was devouring, because I didn't know how right he was about things, because I hadn't started the business of being an advisor. I hadn't actually started trying to acquire clients. I hadn't started trying to serve clients, let alone actually allocate capital or perform financial planning services on behalf of clients. At some point thereafter, Nick may remember exactly when, the newsletter that he did monthly, I think it still stayed as a mailed piece for a while before it went to a PDF.
It sure did.
And I would get that every month, and you know, the whatever the subscription price, I thought then, and I still think now, it was the biggest ripoff I've ever seen. But I mean that the opposite. I mean, I was ripping him off, because let's say I was paying something in the range of $20 a month for something that I would have paid $20 a day for. I read it every month, and I had a lot of success as an advisor right out the gate. But what I don't think Nick's biggest value add to my life and career was in the way I built the business. It was what to do when you have a business. And what I mean by this is relating to clients and believing that a person who could become a client, that you're entering a relationship of trust, and if they don't trust you, then they shouldn't be your client. And I think that more or less, I have had a very happy career, not merely because of the economic success and the enterprise value we've built in our firm and the income and all those things that obviously were our big focus. They were a much bigger focus when I was 27 than they are now that I'm 50, because you know, now I'm not desperate anymore, and in my 20s I was desperate. But the peace of mind that is jeopardized by working with a toxic person, and the joy that is realized by only working with people who like you and who you like, I have no ability to price tag that, but that is something I got from the man sitting next to me right now, Nick Murray. That concept has driven pretty much everything I've done for the last 23 years in this business. I do imagine there's certain things here and there over the years that Nick and I might not be exactly totally identical on, but more or less. The general overarching principle of this being a truth teller's business, of the source of the trust you build with your clients being your own trustworthiness, of believing that if someone is not interested in your point of view, does not trust you implicitly, and therefore you will not embark into a professional relationship with them, that it is their loss, not yours, that you are interviewing them, they are not interviewing you. These are not gimmicks or tricks or psychological advantages that one can kind of position. At least they weren't for me. They were a lifestyle, but more importantly, they were a worldview. And so in 2009, Nick began doing an annual symposium here in Manhattan. And 2009 was not a coincidence. In 2008, the whole world blew up. And those of us, including Nick Murray, who are bullish on the U.S. economy, bullish on U.S. stock market returns, bullish on history and bullish on the future, there was an assault on our worldview in the sense of a rather significant, not only decline in housing values and credit and equity values, but in Wall Street in general, there was this sort of general questioning about just the nature of the advice business, the nature of capital markets. And Nick began doing an annual symposium. I've attended every single one that he's ever done. There are obviously a couple of those little COVID interruption deals where it went virtual, but we used to do it at the Marriott East Side, which ironically was at the time owned by Morgan Stanley, where I worked. and it was Kitty Corner from the Waldorf Astoria. It was at 48th Street, Lexington Avenue. Some of my fondest memories coming out of financial crisis. At that point, I had moved to Morgan Stanley. I had a successful business. I became managing director in the firm. And I would walk across the street on some, you know, beautiful fall morning in October. People do not realize how gorgeous New York City is in October. And he'd start at, 6:37 in the morning, a little bagels and lox, and then he would just talk. And I would take it in, and it didn't matter how many times I'd heard what was being said. Year over year, there are always some kind of new articulations and new perspectives, but what was happening that he couldn't have known is that there were new applications, because there are things happening in our own practices, in our own businesses, in our own lives. And even if it's the same wisdom, it now, year over year, gets to be recontextualized to the vantage point of somebody like myself. I was in awe during his Q&A at his ability to respond to questions with utter disdain for stupidity, if it was warranted, and charming wit where it may have been warranted. But anyways, we've done that every year. Now the venue is grown larger and impact larger. But there is very few people, though only those of us in our business know this, that have the respect that Nick Murray has across the financial advisory profession. There are others that may attempt to do newsletters and symposiums and writing and speaking and whatnot. I don't read any of them, follow any of them, pay any of them. And that's not to say that there aren't others who are good, but they're not Nick Murray. And Nick deserves this spot in me identifying him as a mentor in my life, because literally now for 23 years, there's been this constant monthly influence in the way I see things, understand things, and the way that I've built and run my business. Getting rid of clients when you needed to. And so that's the last story I'll tell here before we bring Nick on. In February 2006, I guess I can't say the name of the client, but there was a gentleman we brought in, very wealthy guy, had sold a business that made windowsill furnishings. And naturally, a business like that must have sold for tens of millions of dollars, because windowsill furnishings or decor sounds like a very scalable business. But this was a pre-financial crisis, housing-related things, you know, were just in a bubble. So he had sold. He was very arrogant, difficult, tricky guy. I had built up a good business. I was making a living. Julie and I started having kids. She was a stay-at-home mom. Things were all right, but I wasn't interested in getting rid of business at the time. Now I don't ever think about it. But back then, you know, that it was a difficult deal. So this guy was a drain on me for about a year. And I read Nick. And then I woke up one day and I fired this client, who was a significant part of revenue. I think I replaced him in 3 days. Maybe it was 3 weeks, I don't know. But that moment is when I decided I now had a career as a financial advisor. Not before then. I had a paycheck and I had a good practice. I'd gotten recruited from a good firm to a better firm, all that kind of stuff. But when I fired a big client, that's when I knew I'd made it. And I hate to say, but that was not the last client I fired. But it was the first of significance, and it was a direct result. I never talked to Nick about it, never reached out and asked him for any advice. I didn't need to, because he was giving it to me in the course of his $20 a month advice via newsletter. And $5.2 billion of assets later, 60 plus employees, 7 offices, and more importantly, 25 years of just incredible memories and experiences in what I consider to be the greatest profession in the world, doing the only thing I can imagine doing. I now am sitting down with that gentleman who has had that impact in my life and career. All of that to say, Nick Murray, welcome to Capital Records.
Well, thank you very much, David. I'm happy to be here with you. I'm happy for your success. I'm happy to have had some early part in it. And just before we started, I confessed that I couldn't articulate what it was that you thought I had done for you. Now I have a sense of it. And of course you're right that it's that it's trust. But I think the larger issue for me has always been that if you were going to give advice and be paid for advice, you had to insist that the advice be followed, that it wasn't a suggestion, that you weren't reading a menu, that we fully deserved to be on the level of the finest physicians or the finest attorneys who you turn to for advice, and when they give you the advice, they take it. And our business was, oddly enough, was never like that. Maybe we deserved it. We probably did to some extent decades ago, but that's what it comes down to. It's as simple as that for me. God knows we give the best advice that we're capable of from the deepest parts of our selves. And in addition to that, we give advice that has always worked in the long term, always. And to have that advice quibbled with or quarreled with or rejected in any way, I never understood why anyone of us would take that. If he believed in his advice, and if in fact he was or she was giving advice that had never failed to work in the long term, I just didn't think, I didn't see why we had to sell it to anybody, and I certainly didn't see why we had to keep selling it to people who should have bought it by now. And I guess that's my raison d'etre.
I think that in a sense, that line of thinking, that philosophy that you taught me, it was so convicting to me because there were two reasons. One was moral and related to the client, and one was practical or pragmatic and related to me and my family. What you're saying is why you can't really in good conscience take a fee from somebody that is not following your advice. You're getting paid to not deliver value. Mm-hmm. And that really resonated with me. But then I also believe that the sort of internal corrosive effect of working with people that are disrespecting you, that over time it tears down your own self-worth.
Totally. And you always know that there's somebody else out there who would welcome your advice. You may not know who it is at the moment, but you don't have the energy or the time to open yourself up to that person if your life force is being sucked out by somebody who says, you know, we got to get out of the market because the dollar is losing its reserve status or whatever the apocalypse du jour is. It's at some point you wake up and say, not only do I need this person, but there's someone else who really needs me and would respect and welcome my advice, and I'll never be able to find that person if I keep feeding the ego of this person.
But the motive is always, whether people are, there's varying degrees of self-consciousness, the motive is always that someone can say, I really want to help the person. They want the revenue. They want the client.
Yeah.
There's a short-sightedness to it. Do you think that there is, were you ever tempted to tier the advice that when you're in this stage of your career, you can have a little higher tolerance for bad behavior, and then at a later stage, you tighten it up? Or did you always feel that from the very beginning, there was one way to do this?
No, I certainly didn't feel it from the very beginning. My growth as an advisor was very slow and very painful. But as one acquires the sense, you said the moral sense, and it is very much a moral sense, not just the economic or the financial sense, but the moral sense, that one is guiding people the way they really should be guided, I think it just got easier and easier to say, you know what, this isn't a fit, and let's you go find an advisor who is more congenial to you, whatever that means.
Yeah. Well, and that's the interesting thing is that the business gives you a lot of opportunity for self-rationalization. You know, that you can say, well, if I get rid of them, they're going to go to someone else who's going to really do them wrong. So I guess I'm better off compromising myself because at least then, you know, the client will probably be better taken care of. I think a lot of your stuff helped me get through, avoid self-deception.
I don't think that I ever went there. And I'm glad to hear you think I didn't go there. No. I take a relatively tragic view of human nature.
Yeah.
With regard to financial planning in general, but investments in particular. And I guess I slowly came over the years, a lot of years, to think that that human nature is a failed investor. That there's so much programmed into our psyches that without proper counsel, human nature is going to go off the rails investment-wise, if not financially in general. And you get to the point, I think, and you got to it very early, where you say, this is not a person I can help because this is not a person who chooses to be helped. And that's not my fault. Yes, he will go to someone who panders to him and will do what he wants to do or won't argue with what he wants to do, and it will probably end badly, but I have to plow my 40 acres. And plowing my 40 acres means to me financially, morally, from the standpoint of the energy that I can bring to my family and my life, I have to draw the line. And I think you as quickly as anyone I've known, you got to that point. And I think it's why you are where you are today.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that the element that you refer to about our families is very important because I think a lot of people feel if they're happy at work, they come home potentially more in a good mood or whatnot. But you know, the business is in has a certain embedded uncertainty around it because markets do what they do and whatnot. But I think that gets underestimated how important it is that the energy, the dynamic with clients. If you're largely arguing with clients all day and you think you're going to go home and be a loving father and husband, you're living in la-la.
Absolutely.
And that was something that I think you got through out of your teaching right, or very early on. Where did you start in your career, Nick?
I started as a retail stockbroker trainee at the late lamented E.F. Hutton and Company on the 1st of May, 1967.
And where was the S&P in 1967, dare I ask?
I'm going to guess it was around 100.
And the Dow was probably right around 800.
I wonder. I don't have any strong sense of that.
I know the sort of famous 66 to 81 market, if it ended at 800, somewhere around there, would have been in that range. So in the course of your lifetime and career from when you started in production at E.F. Hutton to, as we sit here today, in your advisory to advisor business, S&P has gone from 100 to over 5,000.
Indeed.
You had an idea that you used to share. I haven't heard you bring it up a lot lately, maybe because of the obsolete nature of postage stamps in this day and age, but I did what you suggested. You remember that old idea of the postage stamp on the back of a business card?
Yeah. One of the elements of my belief that human nature is a failed investor is that people can't tell the difference between currency and money. And so they endow the idea of doing things that make your currency go sideways as being safe somehow, refusing all of the evidence of their senses, which is that the cost of everything is going up all the time. And so I guess if I had a coherent idea early in the game, and if I did, it was one of very few, it was that long-term investments were for one reason and one reason only, and that was to defeat inflation. That it was not just for stocks to go up, but for stocks to go up and raise their dividends at a significant premium to inflation. And
is another way of saying it, to just protect purchasing power.
And that's, in my own bonehead, simplistic way, that's what the stamps were about. I went around with a stamp from the current year and a stamp from 30 years ago, which is about what I think the average two-person retirement of this day and age is going to be about. Look, as a proxy for the cost of living, look where a stamp was 30 years ago, look where a stamp is now. What are you doing to keep up with that, much less get ahead of it? And that was an illustration that worked really well for me, based on an impulse to simplify.
Yeah.
And I think that's the underlying element in the way I approached people and the way I approached the business and the way I talk to advisors now. It's how simple can you make it without doing violence to the underlying concept?
Yeah.
Einstein said everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. And that's one of the things that I've tried to do.
Well, and I think that the postage stamp very much did that, and even if today, because people are a little less used to mailing a letter than they used to be, the principle's still the same. It could be a different consumer product, but the notion of investing to keep up purchasing power, you had a way of expressing this idea with the postage stamp. In a B2B context, from practitioner to practitioner, you had another construct that I borrowed on heavily over the years. And I've always wanted to ask you this question. I had taped at the bottom of my computer monitor through the first few years I was building my business at Payne Webber, P equals 1 over N. Do you believe, I'm going to explain it in a moment, or let you explain it, but I wonder if you believe that that is a unique formula to our business, or is there universal application?
Tell your audience what it means.
So essentially, those of us who are out and day-to-day engaged in client acquisition, business development, mm-hmm. that P, a qualified prospect, equaled 1 over N, the number of attempts, efforts, activities you did, and all you had to do was find your N, and then you didn't worry about a lost P because you knew the formula for getting a successful P, a conversion of a prospective client to a client. And so it basically reduced, it was a tautology for one thing, by definition, it's true. But it helped people, I think, focus on that the key input was not the closing of the next P, but it was the N that would drive the P because of
math. In the long run, the quality of your business was going to be an absolute function of the number of people you showed your work to.
Right.
And that worrying about how any one person responded to it, or feeling personally rejected by any one person or any 10 people or any 20 people's turning you aside, that the law of large numbers was going to get you wherever you wanted to go, and that was just a again, a very simplistic way of trying to take the anxiety out of it.
It seems like it's an algebraic expression of another line that you use a lot that I think is incredibly wise, the focus on inputs, not outcomes.
Yeah.
And that when we are doing the inputs, we are putting the material together, we know we're organizing a right strategy, solution, interaction with a particular person, we're delivering truth. We're delivering wisdom.
Yes, that's the critical thing.
And that we can control that, but we cannot control the outcome.
Nor should we try.
I think that that needs to be put up at the top of Nick Murray's contributions to myself and probably to an awful lot of people, in that it's very hard to be discouraged once you accept that the thing you're discouraged by is totally out of your control.
I would argue it's impossible to be discouraged by it.
It's certainly irrational. And intellectually, it's incoherent. And yet, I think some people need to take more responsibility for the inputs, and they need to divorce themselves from responsibility of the outcomes. In a way, P equals 1 over N is kind of that. Focus on the N, the P comes, go to work.
Indeed.
So if you sold vacuum cleaners for a living, or if you sold typewriters in the 1960s for IBM, would P equals 1 over N still apply?
Sure.
Why not?
Why not?
But you never thought of it that way. You just thought of it as an advisor profession piece of wisdom.
I thought of it, again, as a boneheaded way of trying to leech the anxiety of building a business out of it. Yeah. Of staving off the despair that we're all at risk of when we're building a business, which is, this is never going to work. I'm never going to get there. And what I said from my own bitter experience was, you're inevitably going to get there as long as you don't stop. And there was that.
Do you believe still a line that I know I'm quoting verbatim because I remember it so distinctly? You used to say in the early years of the event we would do here in Manhattan in 09, 010, you have the life you want.
Yes, you absolutely have the life you want. And if you claim that you don't want the life you have, what are you doing about it? We're the product of our thought. We're the product of what we do all day long. And if we get to the end of the day, and especially if we get to the end of a lot of days, and it's not working, it is still what we produced. And I don't think that has anything to do with the business. I think that has to do with life. Change your mind. Change your mind.
So change your mind as a means to then changing your actions.
Sure. And if anything, that will change. Ultimately, that will change the outcomes.
Well, I kind of cut you off from your story because I know if you entered the business May 1st, 1967, some of these things you're talking about regarding behavioral modification, long-term outcomes, they could not have been the focus of Wall Street in the stock brokerage profession.
Good Lord, no. This was the tail end, the dying years of go-go.
And did that make it an enjoyable time to be in the business or a challenging time?
It was a terrible time. In the sense that the guys who went ashore on D-Day who had never seen combat, that was a terrible experience. But if you survived it and you learned from it as you fought all the way across Europe in the bloodiest event in human history, the knowledge that you acquired became priceless. It clearly became priceless. I feel that way about that period. By the way, I don't think that I would have been taken on by E.F. Hutton at the age of 23 if it were not that sort of go-go youth culture guys coming in who had no adult memory and therefore huge enthusiasm for what they were selling. I bless the fact that it was those days. I'm not sure that somebody with my resume could get taken on by a major firm these days. It was a dreadful time. Basically, you mentioned the Dow, which the Dow, I think, made an intraday high in 1966, which is the year before I came in, and closed over 1,000 in 1981 or two. So, and in between, you had the nightmare of runaway inflation on a scale that we had never seen before, or even since, other than very briefly. But it just went on and on and on. It was from D-Day to the Rhine, if you will.
So did you stay at E.F. Hutton all through that period, 60s, 70s, into the 80s?
I did not. I was at E.F. Hutton for 8 years, and then I went to Sandy Wiles, Shearson, Hayden Stone, which was in 1975, was just coming together as what would become the second largest brokerage firm in the country, and I was there for about 8 years, and then I was with Bear Stearns for the next eight.
And at some point, correct me if I'm wrong, E.F. Hutton ended up coming into the Shearson, what became Shearson Lehman world, through another acquisition, but you were
long after my time.
After that,
long after my time.
And then you ended at Bear Stearns. So you're on Wall Street, and you're in the private wealth retail side of the business through these decades. And there isn't much of a professionalization of financial planning at that time.
Slowly but surely, I was actually speaking of things that could never happen again. I was a founding director of the New York City chapter of what was then called the International Association of Financial Planning, now the Financial Planning Association, in 1975. And that was the very first beginnings of the idea that at the level of a normal family, their financial lives should be coordinated. Up until that time, it was just the banks selling against the insurance companies, selling against the stockbrokers. What the disaster of the 70s taught me, among many other things, was that there was no rationality outside of planning. However you did it, however you patched it together, there had to be a coherent plan. And that was, in those days, a fairly novel idea.
This is a message from our friends at American Habits from the State Policy Network. We the people, do you ever think about what that means and what happened to it? We the people certainly did not mean an imperial city full of unelected bureaucrats deciding everything from kindergarten curricula to nursing home funding formulas. We the people means self-government, a free people deciding most things in their families and communities and delegating some authority to their towns and states while passing along just a small amount of that power to the national government. How did things get so upside down? At American Habits, we tell stories of real people with real solutions, all working to restore federalism and self-government. If you're a public official, Come get involved. If you're a citizen, come and see the new standard for American leadership. No matter who you are, come help us renew the forgotten but not lost habit of American self-government. Visit AmericanHabits.org to learn more. That's AmericanHabits.org.
Was it resisted? You talk a lot about us in our profession needing to be countercultural because we're fighting against human nature, which you described as a failed investor. We were fighting against the media, which is something we'll talk about more in a moment. But was there a resistance to the idea of attaching investment management to planning?
It was an idea whose time was coming. Was it resisted? Sure. But it was resisted with less and less conviction. You had, I remember in 1975 or 1976 at what was, I guess by that time, Shearson Loeb Rhodes, you had the firm helping people become CFPs. Was it still largely a stock and bond culture? Yeah, but the idea was coming.
I wonder how much of that was just related to the incentives of compensation, that on one hand, planning and some of these more consultative ideas were out there, but the compensation was still commission-driven, therefore kind of hard to get, pull people out of that.
Yes. Fees took their own time to come in. And it was hard. It was hard to do planning in a commission-driven environment. But again, morally, you came to the conclusion, what choice did you have?
What year did you write Excellent Investment Advisor?
1997.
And then New Financial Advisor came out 2001.
I finished drafting the New Financial Advisor on September 11, 2001.
I think when you read them now, you notice that your point about more consultative business, in Excellent Investment Advisor, there was a lot of talk about the load funds versus no load and getting paid for advice. And then by the time New Financial Advisor came out, the kind of fee-based approach had been a little more permeated. It's funny, I don't think enough about how fortunate I was with timing, because I can say, and it'd be true, that I never did a commission, but I entered the business right at the time at which fee-based business had become a thing. And so it's fascinating how much easier it was to build a business with off of advice and fees as opposed to convert a business from transactions and commissions to fees. Many of my colleagues that already had an incumbent commission transactional business never were really quite, they would convert like 50% and feel like, you know, they had done their deal, where I think I had a kind of lucky timing of just building it the right way to begin with.
Well, it gives you hope in the business. I think the business gets secularly better, secularly saner. I'm hugely optimistic about the business of financial planning and the business of wealth management. I think we're in a golden age and entering a golden age of financial planning. There's just so much more wealth among ordinary people, and the issues that they're facing are just so complex that, you know, when I started out, you would say, here's a stock we think is going up, or we think the market's going up. And what was your basis for that? But here, people are coming into the business and they're saying, all right, you have to take care of the protection piece. People's lives have to be insured. Their income has to be insured. And when you got that, then you can start investing for retirement in all manner of tax-protected ways of approaching that. And then there's if you do this right, there's going to be a significant estate. First of all, there's going to be a 30-year retirement with all the multitudinous challenges of that, inflation being the primary one, I think. And just more and more ordinary people with significant estates. It's a thrilling time to be in the business, I think.
When I know you get asked these questions a lot because I see them in the newsletter, I hear them at our annual event, and I also just don't believe that people are asking totally different questions to you than the types of things that I have to hear all the time. When you say you entered the business in May of 1967, I'm aware of what happened at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. People right now, as we are getting ready to go through what I imagine will be a reasonably unpleasant and somewhat obnoxious election 2024, there seems to be a tendency to believe that this is the first time our country's ever seen political turmoil. This is, you know, okay, that's great. You've always been a long-term equity guy, but, you know, now we have political tribalism where we apparently never had that before, or now we have excessive government debt where we never had that before. Entering the business in the late 60s, as you did, being a history reader, as I know you to be, how important do you think it is that people who are going to be in the advice business know their history?
Well, I think it's terribly important that they know as much history as possible, not just financial history. Mm-hmm. Although I think everybody in the profession should be a reader of financial history. It's because you can't get surprised. The larger question of whether anybody is reading American history anymore is a question for the times. But I think people go nuts around elections because people go nuts around elections. Quadrennially, the investing public goes bananas. My experience is that that's always been the case. Always been the case. There's just different gradations of craziness. I mean, if you said to me in 1968, the President of the United States will get heckled at the State of the Union message, I would have said, no, a lot of bad stuff is likely to happen, but that, no, we wouldn't descend to that kind of bear baiting. So if you want me to say, if someone wants me to say things are worse now than they ever were, there's some merit to that argument, and it's very limited merit. What I ask anybody about is, how do you work this into your investment policy? How do you work this into your financial plan? If you know anything about long-term investing, you know you got to be in equities. If you know anything about equities, you know that the key to them is long-term compounding. As the late lamented Charles Munger said, the first thing about compounding is never to interrupt it unnecessarily. You're going to get out of the market and then wait for the election, and then you're going to get back in the market. It's a way of people letting out their anxieties about the election because they feel unable to control anything else about it. I'll get out of the market, you know, this kind of thing.
The other concept that I think, by the time I may have heard this expression from you, I had done a lot more study in behavioral finance, but the concept of regret. being this emotion that was so counterproductive to investor success, where I'm used to thinking of the painful decision or the expensive decision being the choice to exit a good investment plan. But you talked about how then, subsequent to the decision to exit, comes the regret, which makes the reentry all the more difficult, rinse and repeat, this negative feedback loop that regret creates, and the only way to avoid it being not to make the first mistake to begin with.
Really?
It's a brilliant concept.
Well, it's my experience. What I actually say is that the most powerful emotion in investing, because it is so long-lived, is long-term regret, is the regret of making the big mistake, whether it was out of terror or out of euphoria. Making the big mistake, and what that does to the psyche of some, you have had clients, I have had clients, who never recovered from it.
That's right.
But how do you convince somebody that he's going to regret something for the rest of his life? My experience is, you don't. It comes back to this issue of people trusting your advice and people allowing themselves to be helped and not second-guessing the advice and saying, yes, I realize you're reminding me that this is what I signed up for, that I was going to go through this cycle of terror and euphoria, and that I had to try to tune it out because I couldn't make rational investment policy out of it. And to me, this is, again, because what we're ultimately fighting is human nature, this never goes away, and it doesn't get worse and it doesn't get better, it just gets human.
Is it fair to say that the human nature doesn't get worse, but I think it's that we have the application of this worse in this sense, the media. That in 1967, human nature is the same as it is in 2024. I was born in 1974, and you went through that horrific bear market. And then, of course, we talk about long, reasonably flattish type period in American equities and the stagflation of the 70s. I only attach it to this reason, not for partisan reasons, but for just historical timing. The Reagan years in the 80s, the Clinton years in the 90s, there was just a really powerful bull market that happened in American economy. But there also was then this creation of what was formerly FNN, Financial News Network. CNN bought, acquired, spun off, and then CNBC was formed. I think when I first began reading you, the kind of exclusive hub of what many would deem financial pornography, a term I did steal from you, was CNBC. The internet changed a lot of that. Now, social media. Combined with internet, with streaming and multiple cable opportunities, not just one. But I don't think any of it's new. It's still the same human nature that plays into euphoria or fear.
Yes.
But there's opportunities for that to go hyperbolic.
Well, I don't know. Are there more opportunities for that to go hyperbolic than there ever were before? I don't.
You had the newsletter industry in the 70s, right? Was that people writing the fear and gloom newsletters about the apocalypse and gold bugs and all this type
of stuff? I'm more conscious of stock tip newsletters in the 1960s and 70s.
So, but it's the other side of the same coin, playing into euphoria, the gold bugs playing into fear. But I guess my point is people have quick access now. If they want to get panicked, their emotion's already there, human nature's already there.
Sure.
but there's an opportunity to pour a little more kerosene on the fire with the internet.
Well, I think there's two things. I think that the screaming, the noise of that people are surrounded by today financially is exponentially higher than it was. When I came into the business, you saw the stock tables in the Times in the morning, and then the Post ran fragments of closing prices in the afternoon. And that, if you didn't call your broker, you wouldn't know. Yeah. Nobody said in the media what had happened in Wall Street today. So if I look at that and I look at the cacophony, the screaming of streaming and social media, which is so destructive, and all of the noise, I say, yes, the level of noise is exponentially higher than it used to be. Does that cause people? And the other thing, of course, is that they can push a button. They don't have to call anybody. And they can push a button for no commission. Yeah. And does that make human nature significantly more of a danger to itself than it always was? Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I guess.
I still go back and forth because I still believe the Book of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun.
Absolutely nothing.
And yet there just are ways in which these things may manifest itself. But, I mean, if it wasn't this, it could be something different. The point, I think, is, that you make over and over is that human nature is the failed investor. And that most of what we deal with in the advisory profession is some form of a distinctly human malfunction, whether mm-hmm. it be
yeah.
euphoria or panic. And it's interesting that we're so used to thinking about this in the context of fear and panic. Certainly some of the seminal moments in my career, you think about the last 25 years, we had 9/11, which coincided with the dot-com implosion and a very mild national recession. And we also then, 7 years later, had the mother of them all with the global financial crisis.
Yep.
And then now, more recently, the COVID moment. So these are rather significant events, but when you think about the course of human history, the only thing that would be unique is if there wasn't any event at all, just some drawdown, to use an equity term, but recessionary event, newsworthy event, that's the norm, not the exception. But humans in euphoric moments, this seems to me to be an underrated risk for advisors, that it, when all of a sudden the person's so worried about the next apocalypse, then flips on you as to, so worried I'm going to miss the next 60,000 move in Bitcoin or whatever the hell it is.
Again, it's just human nature. I came into business in 1967, and I was dealing with clients as any of us would be dealing with clients at any time in our careers, largely between age 50 and age 70. Mm-hmm. Okay? All right, longer now, but... And I sat there and I said, if I'm talking to a 50-year-old in 1967, he was born in 1917. Am I doing the math right? Or is it 1907?
07.
Even worse. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. This is somebody who lived through the stock market crash and the depression and the complete liquidation of the American economy. And you would think had learned to be terrified of the stock market, completely terrified of the stock market, that you would never get over that. And here they were speculating on Ling Temco Vought. I mean, on these, what did they call them then? I've lost the word, conglomerates. And new issues and anything with computer leasing in it, people going nuts at the top of a market. It's just human.
They were afraid of missing out, just like they're afraid of missing out of the next big thing now.
I guess.
And I've made that point that I don't know that we had even kind of slept off the hangover at .com before people started flipping condos and doing all
of this. Well, but that was, they had taken it, all of those speculative instincts and applied them to real estate, which couldn't possibly go down.
So fear doesn't ever become a new permanent paradigm. We just vacillate or oscillate between fear and panic or fear and euphoria.
I think it's between fear and another kind of fear. I think all negative emotions, maybe this is trying to dig too deep into it, but I think all negative emotions are offshoots of fear. So it at the bottom, it's fear of having your entire net worth destroyed. And at the top, it's fear of watching people you know are 10 times dumber than you coining money and yelling in your face about it, which is what always happens.
The aforementioned Charlie Munger that you brought up has a line about, at the end of the day, envy is a more powerful force than greed. That was certainly true through the housing bubble. People could not tolerate seeing their neighbor who, as you say, either was or they perceived to be dumber than them, making that easy money. The other side of this coin, this is a good way for us to start to wrap things up, because this is a definite Nick Murray philosophy that I adopted many years ago, that all of this negative emotion comes from fear, but the positive comes from love.
Yeah, very much so.
Love of family, love of relationships, love of transcendent truth.
Love of country. Love of capitalism, love of all the Enlightenment values. I think, why do I own a life insurance policy that I pay tens of thousands of dollars a year on and have for 30 years? Why do I do that rather than buying a boat? I mean, maybe that's an extreme example, but all good long-term financial decisions purely come from love. I'm convinced of it. Mm-hmm. And that's the only antidote to fear. That is the antidote to fear.
But I think that bringing this back to the advisory profession, that reality is true for all people. It's universal. Mm-hmm. The antidote to fear is love. In the advisory profession, I think that those of us who really take the profession seriously, are calling within it, they have to appreciate that what they're doing has to be driven by love in a very specific sense, that you love a value system, you love a way of life, the American ideal, though, and certainly people's own religious and ethical belief system. But I think that when I read Nick Murray 25 years ago, 23 years ago, don't take toxic clients, don't take people who don't follow your advice, I had to learn to love the clients that did follow my advice because I was subsidizing my good clients were subsidizing my bad clients.
Yes.
And that wasn't loving.
Mm-mm.
And then I had to love my wife and children enough to not come home at night having been drained from toxic clients.
Or taking out all the pain that was dealt to you during the day on them.
Which sometimes wasn't from clients. Sometimes this comes back to the input outcome. There were a few weeks there in September of 2008, you may recall. I didn't know Morgan Stanley was going to be in business. There were a few months there. We didn't know the national economy, the global credit. There's these moments, 9/11, COVID. That COVID few weeks was a bizarre period of time. But I couldn't come home and take out the frustrations of uncertainty in this profession I chose on my family. But the reason had to be because of love.
Yeah.
So you taught that to me.
Well, thank you. It's a lesson I suspect we all learned the hard way. I certainly did. like every important lesson I ever learned, I'm sorry to say, had to learn it the hard way. There's a lot of good that accrues to longevity.
Well, I appreciate the fact that in your longevity, it's funny how much you talk about retirement, because I think we both use it as a financial term.
Sure.
As opposed to a life description. As best I can tell, in your quote-unquote retirement, I didn't meet you until your career of retirement began, and you were doing all this great work that's had this impact on me. But I think that the longevity you describe and the lessons learned, they become very valuable. And then the ability to mentor and teach others, including, I got to think, there's an awful lot of people that have been influenced and helped by you that have never even expressed it to you the way that I might have done so here today. I mean, there's this ability. Our society seems to be anti-mentorship right now. There's this idea that it's a wonderful thing to get to the beach when you're 50 years old. I turn 50 next month. I keep saying this as I'm touring my book related to defensive work. I need more 75-year-olds counseling me. I need less 25-year-olds counseling me.
Absolutely.
And that's the reason, the longevity. Nick, thanks for taking the time to...
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have been a part of your success. Very glad.
It means a lot to me to have you, and even more, of course, for everything I've said over the last 25 years. I appreciate all of you listening to us as we've conversed about some of these various topics, all of which are obviously near and dear to Nick and myself in our own careers and professions and lives, but hopefully you found some nuggets and takeaways relevant to you. We appreciate your participation in our effort here at National Review's Capitol Record, and I intend to continue in my ongoing endeavor to defend a free and virtuous society. Thanks for listening to Capitol Record.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.